I have 6 other consults waiting for me, the psychiatrist snapped. Sorry to disappoint you. Lacey yelled after him. I'm not the one you're disappointing. She sank down beside Kelly and squeezed her hand. It's okay. I'm going to take care of you. She winged a prayer to whoever might move the mountains that could be men's hearts. Then she lifted her face to the doctor's. First, do no harm, she said softly. The doctor pinched the bridge of his nose. I'll get her an epidural, he sighed, and only then did Lacey realize she had been holding her breath. The last place Josie wanted to go was out to dinner with her mother, so that she could spend 3 hours watching maitre d's and chefs and other guests suck up to her. This was Josie's birthday celebration, so she didn't really understand why she couldn't just demand takeout Chinese and a video. But her mother was insisting that it wouldn't be a celebration if they just stayed at home, and so here she was, trailing after her mother like a lady-in-waiting. She'd been counting. There were 4, nice to see you, your honors. 3, yes, your honors. 2, my pleasure, your honors. And 1, for your honor, we have the best table in the house. Sometimes Josie read about celebrities in People magazine who were always getting handouts from purse companies and shoe stores and free tickets to opening nights on Broadway and Yankee Stadium. When you got right down to it, her mother was a celebrity in the town of Sterling. I cannot believe, her mother said, that I have a 12-year-old. Is that my cue to say something like, you must have been a child prodigy? Her mother laughed. Well, that would work. I'm going to be driving in 3.5 years, Josie pointed out. Her mother's fork clattered against the plate. Thanks for that. The waiter came over to the table. Your honor, he said, setting a platter of caviar down in front of Josie's mother. The chef would like you to have this appetizer with his compliments. That's so gross. Fish eggs? Josie! Her mother smiled stiffly at the waiter. Please thank the chef. She could feel her mother's eyes on her as she picked at her food. What? She challenged. Well, you sounded like a spoiled brat, that's all. Why? Because I don't like fish embryos sitting under my nose? You don't eat them either. I was at least being honest. And I was being discreet, her mother said. Don't you think that the waiter is going to tell the chef that Judge Cormier's daughter is a piece of work? Like I care? I do. What you do reflects on me, and I have a reputation I have to protect. As what? A suck-up? As someone who's above criticism, both in and out of the courtroom. Josie tilted her head to one side. What if I did something bad? Bad? How bad? Let's say I was smoking pot, Josie said. Her mother froze. Is there something you want to tell me, Josie? God, Mom, I'm not doing it. This is hypothetical. Because, you know, now that you're in middle school, you're going to start coming across kids who do things that are dangerous or just plain stupid, and I would hope you'd be strong enough to know better than that, Josie finished, echoing her in a sing-song. Yeah, got it. But what if, Mom? What if you came home and found me getting stoned in the living room? Would you turn me in? What do you mean, turn you in? Call the cops. Hand over my stash, Josie grinned. Of hash. No, her mother said. I wouldn't report you. Josie used to think, when she was younger, that she would grow up to look like her mother, fine-boned, dark-haired, light-eyed. The combination of elements were all there in her features, but as she'd gotten older, she started to look like someone else entirely, someone she had never met, her father. She wondered if her father, like Josie herself, could memorize things in a snap and picture them on a page just by closing his eyes. She wondered if her father sang off-key and liked to watch scary movies. She wondered if he had the straight slash of eyebrows so different from her mother's delicate arches. She wondered, period. "If you didn't report me because I'm your daughter," Josie said, "then you're not really being fair, are you?" "I'd be acting like a parent, not a judge." Her mother reached across the table and put her hand on Josie's, which felt weird. Her mother wasn't one of these touchy-feely types. "Josie, you can come to me, you know. If you need to talk, I'm there to listen. You're not going to get into legal trouble, no matter what you tell me. Not if it's about you, not even if it's about your friends." To be perfectly honest, Josie didn't have many of those. There was Peter, who she'd known forever, although Peter no longer came to her house, and vice versa. They still hung out together in school, and he was the last person in the world Josie could ever imagine doing anything illegal. She knew that one of the reasons other girls excluded Josie was because she always stuck up for Peter, but she told herself that it didn't matter. She didn't really want to be surrounded by people who only cared about what happened on One Life to Live and who saved their babysitting money to go to the Limited. They seemed so fake sometimes that Josie thought if she poked one of them with a sharp pencil, they'd burst like a balloon. So what if she and Peter weren't popular? She was always telling Peter it didn't matter. She might as well start to believe it herself. Josie pulled her hand away from her mother and pretended to be fascinated by her cream of asparagus soup. There was something about asparagus that she and Peter found hilarious. They'd done an experiment once to see how much you had to eat before your pee smelled weird, and it was less than 2 bites, swear to God. "Stop using your judge voice," Josie said.
"My what?"
"Your judge voice. It's the one you use when you answer the phone, or when you're out in public, like now." Her mother frowned. "That's crazy. It's the same voice I..." The waiter glided over, as if he were skating across the dining room. "I don't mean to interrupt. Is everything to your liking, Your Honor?" Without missing a beat, her mother turned her face up to the waiter. "It's gorgeous," she said, and she smiled until he walked away. Then she turned to Josie. "It's the same voice I always use." Josie looked at her, and then at the waiter's back.
"Maybe it is," she said.
The other kid on the soccer team, who would rather have been anywhere else, was named Derek Markowitz. He'd introduced himself to Peter when they were sitting on the bench during a game against North Haverhill.
"Who forced you to play?"
Derek had asked, and Peter had told him his mother.
"Mine too," Derek admitted. "She's a nutritionist and she's nuts about fitness."
At dinner, Peter would tell his parents that practice was going fine. He made up stories based on plays he'd seen other kids execute, athletic feats that he himself could never have done. He did this so that he could see his mother glance at Joey and say things like, "Guess there's more than one athlete in this family." When they came to cheer him on during games, and Peter never left the bench, he said it was because Coach played his favorites, and in a way, that was true. Like Peter, Derek was just about the worst soccer player on the planet. He was so fair that his veins looked like a road map underneath his skin, and he had such pale hair that you had to search hard to find his eyebrows. Now, when they were at games, they sat next to each other on the bench. Peter liked him because he smuggled Snickers bars into practice and ate them when Coach wasn't looking, and because he knew how to tell a good joke.
"Why did the ref stop the leper hockey game?"
"There was a face-off in the corner."
"What's more fun than stapling Jew Gerard to a wall?"
"Ripping him off." It got to the point where Peter actually was looking forward to soccer practice just to hear what Derek had to say. Although then Peter began to worry again if he liked Derek just because he was Derek or because Peter was gay. And then he'd sit a little farther away or tell himself that no matter what, he wouldn't look Derek in the eye for the whole practice so that he didn't get the wrong idea. They were sitting on the bench one Friday afternoon, watching everyone else play Rivendell. Sterling was expected to be able to kick their collective ass with their eyes closed. Not that that was reason enough for the coach to put Peter or Derek in to actually play during a real league game. The score was climbing to something humiliating in the last minute of the final quarter, Sterling 24, Rivendell 2, and Derek was telling Peter another joke. A pirate walks into a bar with a parrot on his shoulder, a peg leg, and a steering wheel on his pants, Derek said. The bartender says, "Hey, you've got a steering wheel on your pants." And the pirate goes, "Arr, I know. It's driving me nuts." "Good game," the coach said, congratulating each of the players with a handshake. "Good game. Good game."
"You coming?" Derek asked, standing up. "I'll meet you in there," Peter said. And as he leaned down to retie his cleats, he saw a pair of ladies' shoes stop in front of him. A pair he recognized because he was always tripping over them in the mud room.
"Hi, baby," his mother said, smiling down. Peter choked. What middle school kid had mommy come to pick him up right at the field, as if he were leaving nursery school and needed a hand crossing the street?
"Just give me a second, Peter," his mother said.
He glanced up long enough to see that the team hadn't gone into the locker room as usual, but hung around to watch this latest humiliation. Just when he thought it couldn't get any worse, his mother marched up to the coach.
"Coach Yabrowski," she said, "could I have a word?"
"Kill me now," Peter thought.
"I'm Peter's mother, and I'm wondering why you don't play my son during the games."
"It's a matter of teamwork, Mrs. Houghton, and I'm just giving Peter the chance to come up to speed with some of the other—"
"It's halfway through the season, and my son has just as much right to play on this soccer team as any of the other boys."
"Mom," Peter interrupted, wishing that there were earthquakes in New Hampshire, that a ravine would open under her feet and swallow her mid-sentence.
"Stop."
"It's all right, Peter. I'm taking care of it." The coach pinched the bridge of his nose. "I'll put Peter in on Monday's game, Mrs. Houghton, but it isn't going to be pretty."
"It doesn't have to be pretty. It just has to be fun."
She turned around and smiled, clueless, at Peter. "Right?"
Peter could barely hear her. Shame was a shot that rang in his ears, broken only by the buzz of his teammates.
His mother squatted down in front of him. He had never really understood what it meant to love someone and hate them at the same time, but now he was starting to get it.
"Once he sees you on that field, you'll be playing first string."
She patted his knee.
"I'll wait for you in the parking lot."
The other players laughed as he pushed past them.
"Mama's boy," they said. "Does she fight all your battles, homo?"
In the locker room, he sat down and pulled off his cleats. He had a hole in the toe of one sock, and he stared at it as if he were truly amazed by that fact, instead of because he was trying so hard not to cry. He nearly jumped out of his skin when he felt someone sit down beside him.
"Peter," Derek said, "you okay?"
Peter tried to say yes, but just couldn't get the lie through his throat.
"What's the difference between this team and a porcupine?" Derek asked.
Peter shook his head.
"A porcupine has pricks on the outside."
Derek grinned.
"See you Monday."
Courtney Ignacio was a spaghetti strap girl. That's what Josie called that posse, for lack of a better term. The girls who wore belly-bearing tanks and who, during the student-run recitals, made up dances to the songs Bootylicious and Lady Marmalade. Courtney had been the first seventh grader to get a cell phone. It was pink, and sometimes it even rang in class, but teachers never got angry at her. When she was paired with Courtney in social studies to make a timeline of the American Revolution, Josie had groaned. She was sure she'd be pulling all the weight. But Courtney had invited her over to work on the project, and Josie's mother told her that if she didn't go, she would be stuck doing all the work. So now she was sitting on Courtney's bed, eating chocolate chip cookies and organizing note cards.
"What?" Courtney said, standing in front of her with her hands on her hips.
"What, what? Why do you have that look on your face?" Josie shrugged. "Your room. It's totally different than mine."
Courtney glanced around, as if seeing her bedroom for the first time.
"Different how?"
Courtney had a wild purple shag rug and beaded lamps strung with gauzy silk scarves for atmosphere. An entire dresser top was dedicated to makeup. A poster of Johnny Depp hung on the back of her door, and a shelf sported a state-of-the-art stereo system. She had her own DVD player. Josie's room, in comparison, was Spartan. She had a bookshelf, a desk, a dresser, and a bed. Her comforter looked like an old lady quilt compared to Courtney's satin one. If Josie had any style at all, it was early American dork.
"Just different," Josie said.
"My mom's a decorator. She thinks this is what every teenage girl dreams of."
"Do you?"
Courtney shrugged.
"I kind of think it looks like a bordello, but I don't want to ruin it for her. Let me just go get my binder and we can start."
When she left to go back downstairs, Josie found herself staring into the mirror. Drawn forward to the dresser with makeup on it, she found herself picking up tubes and bottles that were completely unfamiliar. Her mother rarely wore any makeup, maybe lipstick, but that was it. Josie lifted a mascara wand and unscrewed the cap, ran her finger over the black bristles. She uncapped a bottle of perfume and sniffed. In the reflection of the mirror, she watched the girl who looked just like her take a tube of lipstick, "positively hot," the label read, and apply it. It put a bloom of color in her face. It brought her to life. Was it really that easy to become someone else?
"What are you doing?"
Josie jumped at the sound of Courtney's voice. She watched in the mirror as Courtney came forward and took the lipstick out of her hands.
I'm sorry,"
Josie stammered. To her surprise, Courtney Ignacio grinned.
"Actually," she said, "it suits you."
Joey got better grades than his younger brother. He was a better athlete than Peter. He was funnier. He had more common sense. He could draw more than a straight line. He was the one people gravitated toward at a party. There was only one thing, as far as Peter could tell, and he'd been counting, that Joey could not do, and that was stand the sight of blood. When Joey was 7 and his best friend went over the handlebars of his bike and opened a cut over his forehead, it was Joey who passed out. When a medical show was on television, he had to leave the room. Because of this, he'd never gone hunting with his father, although Lewis had promised his boys that as soon as they turned 12, they were old enough to come out with him and learn how to shoot. It seemed as if Peter had been waiting all fall for this weekend. He had been reading up on the rifle his father was going to let him use, a Winchester Model 94, lever-action 30-30 that had been his father's, before the purchase of the bolt-action Remington 721 30-06 he used now to hunt deer.
Now, at 4:30 in the morning, Peter could barely believe he was holding it in his hands, the safety carefully locked. He crept through the woods behind his father, his breath crystallizing in the air. It had snowed last night, which was why the conditions were perfect for deer hunting. They'd been out yesterday to find fresh scrapes, spots on live trees where a buck had rubbed his antlers and returned to scrape over and over, marking its territory. Now it was just a matter of finding the same spot and checking for fresh tracks to see if the buck had come through yet. The world was different when there was no one in it. Peter tried to match his father's footsteps, setting his boot into the print left behind by his father. He pretended he was in the army, on a guerrilla mission. The enemy was right around the corner. At any moment now, he might be surprised into an exchange of fire.
"Peter," his father hissed over his shoulder, "keep your rifle pointed up."
They approached the ring of trees where they had seen the rub. Today, the antler scrapes were fresh, the white flesh of the tree and the pale green strip of peeled bark chafed raw. Peter looked down at his feet. There were three sets of tracks, one much larger than the other two.
"He's already been through here," Peter's father murmured. "He's probably following the does."
Deer in rut weren't as smart as usual. They were so focused on the does they were chasing, they forgot to avoid the humans who might be hunting them. Peter and his father walked softly through the woods, following tracks toward the swamp. Suddenly, his father stuck out his hand, a signal to stop. Glancing up, Peter could see two does, one older, one a yearling. His father turned, mouthing, "Don't move." When the buck stepped out from behind the tree, Peter stopped breathing. It was massive, majestic. Its thick neck supported the weight of a 6-point rack. Peter's father nodded imperceptibly at the gun. "Go ahead." Peter fumbled with the rifle, which felt 30 pounds heavier. He lifted it to his shoulder and got the deer in his sights. His pulse was pounding so hard that the gun kept shaking. He could hear his father's instructions as if they were being whispered aloud even now. "Shoot underneath the front leg, low on the body. If you hit the heart, you'll kill it instantly. If you miss the heart, you'll get the lungs, so it will run for 100 yards or so and then drop." Then the deer turned and looked at him, eyes trained on Peter's face. Peter squeezed the trigger, sending the shot wide, on purpose. The three deer ducked in unison, unsure of where the danger was. Just as Peter wondered whether or not his father had noticed that he wimped out, or simply assumed Peter was a lousy shot, a second shot rang from his father's rifle. The does bolted away. The buck dropped like a stone. Peter stood over the deer, watching blood pump from its heart.
"I didn't mean to steal your shot," his father said. "But if you'd reloaded, they would have heard you and run."
"No," Peter said. He could not tear his eyes from the deer.
"It's okay."
Then he vomited into the scrub brush. He could hear his father doing something behind him, but he wouldn't turn around. Instead, Peter stared hard at a patch of snow that had already begun to melt. He felt his father approach. Peter could smell the blood on his hands, the disappointment. Peter's father reached out, patting his shoulder.
"Next time," he sighed.
Dolores Keating had transferred to the middle school this year in January. She was one of those kids that slipped by unnoticed, not too pretty, not too smart, not a troublemaker. She sat in front of Peter in French class, her ponytail bobbing up and down as she conjugated verbs out loud. One day, as Peter was doing his best not to fall asleep to Madame's recitation of the verb avoir, he noticed that Dolores was sitting in the middle of an ink stain. He thought that was pretty funny, given that she was wearing white pants, and then he realized that it wasn't ink at all.
"Dolores has her period!" he cried out loud, out of sheer shock.
In a house full of males, with the exception of his mother, of course, menstruation was one of those great mysteries about women, like how do they put on mascara without poking out their eyes, and how can they hook a bra behind themselves without seeing what they're doing? Everyone in the class turned, and Dolores's face went as scarlet as her pants. Madame ushered her into the hall, suggesting she go to the nurse. On the seat in front of Peter was a small red puddle of blood. Madame called the custodian, but by then the class was out of control, whispers raging like a brush fire about how much blood there was, how Dolores was now one of the girls that everyone knew had her period.
"Keating's bleeding," Peter said to the kid next to him, whose eyes lit up.
"Keating's bleeding," the boy repeated, and the chant went around the room. "Keating's bleeding, Keating's bleeding." Across the room, Peter caught Josie's eye. Josie, who had started to wear makeup lately. She was singing along with the rest of them. Belonging felt like helium. Peter felt himself swell inside. He'd been the one to start this. By drawing a line around Dolores, he'd become part of the inner circle. At lunch that day, he was sitting with Josie when Drew Gerard and Matt Royston came over with their trays.
"We heard that you saw it happen," Drew said,
and they sat down so that Peter could tell them the details. He began embellishing. A teaspoon of blood became a cup. The stain on her white pants grew from a modest spot to enormous proportion. They called over their friends, some who were kids on Peter's soccer team, yet hadn't spoken to him all year.
"Tell them, too. It's hilarious," Matt said,
and he smiled at Peter, as if Peter were one of them. Dolores stayed out of school. Peter knew that it wouldn't have made any difference if she was gone for a month or more. The memories of sixth graders were steel traps, and for the rest of her high school career, Dolores would always be remembered as the girl who got her period in French class and bled all over the seat. The morning that she came back, she stepped off the bus and was immediately flanked by Drew and Matt.
"For a woman," they said, drawing out the words, "you sure don't have any boobs."
She pushed away from them, and Peter didn't see her again until French class. Someone, he really didn't know who, had come up with a plan. Madame was always late to class. She had to come from the other end of the school. So before the bell rang, everyone would walk up to Dolores's desk and hand her a tampon they'd been given by Courtney Ignacio, who'd pilfered a box from her mother. Drew was first. As he set the tampon on her desk, he said,
"I think you might have dropped this."
6 tampons later, the bell still hadn't rung, and Madame wasn't in the room yet. Peter walked up, holding the wrapped tube in his fist, ready to drop it, and noticed Dolores was crying. It wasn't loud, and it was barely even visible. But as Peter reached out with the tampon, he suddenly realized that this was what it looked like from the other side, when he was being put through hell. Peter crushed the tampon in his fist.
"Stop," he said softly,
and then he turned around to the next 3 students waiting in line to humiliate Dolores.
"Just stop already." "What's your problem, homo?" Drew asked. "It's not funny anymore."
Maybe it was never funny. It was just that it hadn't been him, and that was good enough. The boy behind him shoved Peter out of the way and flicked his tampon so that it bounced off Dolores's head, rolled underneath Peter's seat. And then it was Josie's turn. She looked at Dolores, and then she looked at Peter.
"Don't," he murmured.
Josie pressed her lips together and let the tampon roll from her outstretched fingers onto Dolores's desk.
"Oops,"
she said. And when Matt Royston laughed, she went to stand beside him. Peter was lying in wait. Although Josie hadn't been walking with him for a few weeks now, he knew what she was doing after school, usually strolling into town to get an iced tea with Courtney and company, and then window shopping. Sometimes he stood back at a distance and watched her the way you'd stare at a butterfly that you'd only known as a caterpillar, wondering how the hell change could be that dramatic. He waited until she'd left the other girls, and then he followed her down the street that led to her house. When he caught up to her and grabbed her arm, she shrieked.
"God!" she said. "Peter, why don't you just scare me to death?"
He had worked out what he was going to ask her in his mind, because words didn't come easily to him, and he knew that he had to practice them more than others would. But when he had Josie this close, after everything that had happened, every question felt like a slap. Instead, he sank onto the curb, spearing his hands through his hair.
"Why?"
he asked. She sat down next to him, folding her arms over her knees.
"I'm not doing it to hurt you. You're such a fake with them."
"I'm just not the way I am with you," Josie said.
"Like I said, fake.
There's different kinds of real." Peter scoffed.
"If that's what those jerks are teaching you, it's bullshit."
"They're not teaching me anything," Josie argued. "I'm there because I like them. They're fun and funny, and when I'm with them..." She broke off abruptly.
"What?"
Peter prompted. Josie looked him in the eye.
"When I'm with them," she said, "people like me."
Peter guessed change could be that dramatic. In an instant, you could go from wanting to kill someone to wanting to kill yourself.
"I won't let them make fun of you anymore," Josie promised. "That's a silver lining, right?"
Peter didn't respond. This wasn't about him.
I just can't really hang out with you right now," Josie explained.
He lifted his face.
"Can't?"
Josie stood up, backing away from him.
"I'll see you around, Peter," she said,
and she walked out of his life. To anyone who cares, you can feel people staring. It's like heat that rises from the pavement during summer, like a poker in the small of your back. You don't have to hear a whisper, either, to know that it's about you. I used to stand in front of the mirror in the bathroom to see what they were staring at. I wanted to know what made their heads turn, what it was about me that was so incredibly different. At first, I couldn't tell. I mean, I was just me. Then one day, when I looked in the mirror, I understood. I looked into my own eyes, and I hated myself. Maybe as much as all of them did. That was the day I started to believe they might be right. Ten days after. Josie waited until she could no longer hear the television in her mother's bedroom, Leno, not Letterman, and then rolled onto her side to watch the LED acrobatics of the digital clock. When it was 2 a.m., she decided it was safe, and she pulled back her covers and got out of bed. She knew how to sneak downstairs. She'd done it a couple of times before, meeting Matt outside in the backyard. One night, he had texted her on her cell, "Have to see you now." She had gone out to him in her pajamas, and for a moment, when he touched her, she actually thought she would slip through his fingers. There was only one landing where the floorboards creaked, and Josie knew enough to step over it. Downstairs, she rummaged through the stack of DVDs for the one she wanted, the one she didn't want to be caught viewing. Then she turned on the television, muting the sound so low she had to sit right on top of the screen and its built-in speakers to hear. The first person shown was Courtney. She held up her hand, blocking whoever had been videotaping. She was laughing, though, her long hair falling over her features like a screen of silk. Off-screen, Brady Price's voice. "Give us something for Girls Gone Wild, Court." The camera fuzzed out for a moment, and then there was a close-up of a birthday cake. "Happy Sweet 16, Josie." A run of faces, including Haley Weaver's, singing to her. Josie paused the DVD. There was Courtney and Haley and Maddie and John and Drew. She touched her finger to each of their foreheads, getting a tiny electric shock each time. At her birthday party, they'd had a barbecue at Storr's Pond. There were hot dogs and hamburgers and sweet corn. They had forgotten the ketchup, and someone had to drive back into town to buy some at a mini-mart. Courtney's card had been signed BFF, Best Friends Forever, even though Josie knew she'd written the same thing on Maddie's card a month earlier. By the time the screen fuzzed out again and her own face came on, Josie was crying. She knew what was coming. She remembered this part. The camera panned back, and there was Matt, his arms around her as she sat on his lap on the sand. He had taken off his shirt, and Josie remembered that his skin had been warm where it pressed up against hers. How could you be so alive one moment, and then have everything stop? Not just your heart and your lungs, but the way you smiled slowly, the left side of your mouth curling before the right, and the pitch of your voice, and the habit you had of tugging at your hair when you were doing your math homework. "I can't live without you," Matt used to say. And now Josie realized he wouldn't have to. She couldn't stop sobbing, so Josie pushed her fist into her mouth to keep herself from making noise. She watched Matt on the screen the way you might study an animal you had never seen before, if you had to memorize it and tell the world later what you'd found. Matt's hands splayed across her bare stomach, grazed the edge of her bikini top. She watched herself push him away, blush. "Not here," her voice said. A funny voice, a voice that didn't sound like Josie to her own ears. You never did when you heard yourself on tape.
"Then let's go somewhere else," Matt said.
Josie ruched up the edge of her pajama top until she could reach underneath. She spread her own hand across her belly. She edged her thumb up, like Matt had, to the curve of her breast. She tried to pretend it was him. He had given her a gold locket for that birthday, one she hadn't taken off since that day, nearly 6 months ago. Josie was wearing it on the DVD. She remembered that when she had looked at it in the mirror, Matt's thumbprint had been on the back, left behind after he clasped it around her neck. That had seemed so intimate, and for a few days she had done everything she could to keep it from rubbing off. On the night that Josie had met Matt out in her own backyard, beneath the moon, he had laughed at her pajamas, printed all over with pictures of Nancy Drew. "What were you doing when I texted you?" he asked. "Sleeping. Why did you have to see me in the middle of the night?"
to make sure you were dreaming about me, he said.
On the DVD, someone called out Matt's name. He turned, grinning. His teeth were wolf's teeth, Josie thought. Sharp, impossibly white. He stamped a kiss on Josie's mouth.
Be right back, he said. Be right back.
She pressed pause again, just as Matt stood up. Then she reached around her neck and ripped the locket off its thin gold chain. She unzipped one of the couch cushions and pushed the necklace deep inside the stuffing. She turned off the television. She pretended that Matt would be suspended like that forever, inches away from Josie so that she could still reach out and grab him, even though she knew that the DVD would reset itself even before she left the room. Lacey had known they were out of milk. That morning, as she and Lewis sat like zombies at the kitchen table, she had brought it up.
I hear it's gonna rain again.
We're out of milk.
Have you heard from Peter's lawyer?
It devastated Lacey to know that she could not visit Peter again for another week. Jail rules. It killed her to know Lewis hadn't been there to see him at all yet. How was she supposed to go through the motions of an ordinary day, knowing that her son was sitting in a cell less than 20 miles away? There was a point where the events of your life became a tsunami. Lacey knew, because she had been washed away once before by grief. When that happened, you would find yourself days later on unfamiliar ground, rootless. The only other choice you had was to move to higher ground while you still could. Which is why Lacey found herself at a gas station buying a carton of milk, although all gut instinct told her to crawl under the covers and sleep. This wasn't as easy as it seemed. To get the milk, she had to first back out of her garage with reporters slapping the car windows and blocking her path. She had to elude the news van that followed her to the highway. As a result, she found herself paying for the milk at a service station in Permort, New Hampshire, one she rarely frequented.
That's $2.59, the cashier said.
Lacey opened her wallet and extracted $3 bills. Then she noticed the small, hand-lettered display at the register. Memorial Fund for the Victims of Sterling High, the sign read, and there was a coffee can to hold the donations. She started shaking.
I know, the cashier sympathized. It's just tragic, isn't it?
Lacey's heart was pounding so fiercely she was certain the clerk would hear it.
You gotta wonder about the parents, don't you? I mean, how could they not have known?
Lacey nodded, afraid that even the sound of her voice would ruin her anonymity. It was almost too easy to agree. Had there ever been a more awful child? A worse mother? It was simple to say that behind every terrible child stood a terrible parent, but what about the ones who had done the best they could? What about the ones, like Lacey, who had loved unconditionally, protected ferociously, cherished mightily, and still had raised a murderer?
I didn't know, Lacey wanted to say. It's not my fault.
But she stayed silent because, truth be told, she wasn't quite sure she believed that. Lacey emptied the contents of her wallet into the coffee can, bills and coins. Numb, she walked out of the gas station, leaving the carton of milk on the counter. She had nothing left inside. She'd given it all to her son. And that was the greatest heartbreak of all. No matter how spectacular we want our children to be, no matter how perfect we pretend they are bound to disappoint. As it turns out, kids are more like us than we think. Damaged through and through. Irvin Peabody, the professor of psychiatry at the college, offered to run a grief session for the entire town of Sterling at the white clapboard church in its center. There was a tiny line item in the daily paper and purple flyers posted at the coffee shop and bank, but that was enough to spread the word. By the time the meeting convened at 7 p.m., cars were parked as far as half a mile away. People spilled through the open doors of the church onto the street. The press, which had come en masse to cover the meeting, was turned away by a battalion of Sterling policemen. Selina pressed the baby closer against her chest as another wave of townspeople pushed past her.
"Did you know it was going to be like this?" she whispered to Jordan.
He shook his head, eyes roaming over the crowd. He recognized some of the same people who had come to the arraignment, but also a host of other faces that were new, and that wouldn't have been intimately connected to the high school. The elderly, the college kids, the couples with young babies. They had come because of the ripple effect, because one person's trauma is another's loss of innocence. Irvin Peabody sat in the front of the room, beside the police chief and the principal of Sterling High.
"Hello," he said, standing up. "We've called this session tonight because we're all still reeling. Nearly overnight, the landscape's changed around us. We may not have all the answers, but we thought it might be beneficial for us to start to talk about what's happened. And maybe more importantly, to listen to each other."
A man stood up in the second row, holding his jacket in his hands.
"I moved here 5 years ago because my wife and I wanted to get away from the craziness of New York City. We were starting a family and were looking for a place that was, well, just a little bit kinder and gentler. I mean, when you drive down the street in Sterling, you get honked at by people who know you. You go to the bank and the teller remembers your name. There aren't places like that in America anymore. And now..."
He broke off.
"And now Sterling's not one either," Irvin finished. "I know how difficult it can be when the image you've had of something doesn't match its reality, when the friend beside you turns into a monster."
"Monster?" Jordan whispered to Selina. "Well, what is he supposed to say? That Peter was a time bomb? That'll make them all feel safe."
The psychiatrist looked out over the crowd.
"I think that the very fact that you're all here tonight shows that Sterling hasn't changed. It may not ever be normal again, as we know it. We're going to have to figure out a new kind of normal."
A woman raised her hand.
"What about the high school? Are our kids going to have to go back inside there?"
Irvin glanced at the police chief, the principal.
"It's still the site of an active investigation," the chief said. "We're hoping to finish out the year in a different location," the principal added. "We're in talks with the superintendent's office in Lebanon to see if we can use one of their empty schools."
Another woman's voice.
"But they're going to have to go back sometime. My daughter's only 10, and she's terrified about walking into that high school, ever. She wakes up in the middle of the night, screaming. She thinks there's someone with a gun there, waiting for her."
"Be happy she's able to have nightmares," a man replied.
He was standing next to Jordan, his arms folded, his eyes a livid red.
"Go in there every night when she cries, and hold her, and tell her you'll keep her safe. Lie to her, just like I did."
A murmur rolled through the church, like a ball of yarn being unraveled.
"That's Mark Ignacio, the father of one of the dead."
Just like that, a fault line opened up in Sterling, a ravine so deep and bleak that it would not be bridged for many years. There was already a difference in this town, between those who had lost children and those who still had them to worry about.
"Some of you knew my daughter Courtney," Mark said,
pushing away from the wall. Maybe she babysat for your kids, or served you a burger at the steak shack in the summer. Maybe you'd recognize her by sight, because she was a beautiful, beautiful girl.
He turned to the front of the stage.
You want to tell me how I'm supposed to figure out a new kind of normal, Doc? You wouldn't dare suggest that one day it gets easier, that I'll be able to move past this, that I'll forget my daughter is lying in a grave while some psychopath is still alive and well.
Suddenly, the man turned to Jordan.
How can you live with yourself? He accused. How the hell can you sleep at night knowing you're defending that son of a bitch?
Every eye in the room turned to Jordan. Beside him, he could feel Selena press Sam's face against her chest, shielding the baby. Jordan opened his mouth to speak, but couldn't find a single word. The sound of boots coming up the aisle distracted him. Patrick Ducharme was headed straight for Mark Ignacio.
I can't imagine the pain you're feeling, Mark,
Patrick said, his gaze locked on the grieving man's.
And I know you have every right to come here and be upset. But the way our country works, someone's innocent until they're proven guilty. Mr. McAfee's just doing his job.
He clapped his hand on Mark's shoulder and lowered his voice.
Why don't you and I grab a cup of coffee?
As Patrick led Mark Ignacio toward the exit, Jordan remembered what he had wanted to say.
I live here, too, he began.
Mark turned around.
Not for long.
Alex wasn't short for Alexandra, like most people assumed. Her father had simply given her the name of the son he would have preferred to have. After Alex's mother had died of breast cancer when she was 5, her father had raised her. He wasn't the kind of dad who showed her how to ride a bike or to skip stones. Instead, he taught her the Latin words for things like faucet and octopus and porcupine. He explained to her the Bill of Rights. She used academics to get his attention, winning spelling bees and geography contests, netting a string of straight A's, getting into every college she applied to. She wanted to be just like her father, the kind of man who walked down the street and had storekeepers nod to him in awe. Good afternoon, Judge Cormier. She wanted to hear the change in tone of a receptionist's voice when the woman heard it was Judge Cormier on the line. If her father never held her on his lap, never kissed her goodnight, never told her he loved her, well, it was all part of the persona. From her father, Alex learned that everything could be distilled into facts. Comfort, parenting, love, all of these could be boiled down and explained, rather than experienced. And the law? Well, the law supported her father's belief system. Any feelings you had in the context of a courtroom had an explanation. You were given permission to be emotional in a logical setting. What you felt for your clients wasn't really what was in your heart, or so you could pretend, so that no one ever got close enough to hurt you. Alex's father had had a stroke when she was a second-year law student. She had sat on the edge of his hospital bed and told him she loved him.
Oh, Alex,
he'd sighed.
Let's not bother with that.
She hadn't cried at his funeral, because she knew that's what he would have wanted. Had her own father wished, as she did now, that the basis of their relationship had been different? Had he eventually given up hoping, settling for teacher and student instead of parent and child? How long could you march along on a parallel track with your child before you lost any chance of intersecting her life? She'd read countless websites about grief and its stages. She'd studied the aftermath of other school shootings. She could do research, but when she tried to connect with Josie, her daughter looked at her as if she'd never seen her before. At other times, Josie burst into tears. Alex didn't know how to combat either outcome. She felt incompetent. And then she'd remember that this wasn't about her. It was about Josie. And she'd feel even more like a failure. The great irony hadn't escaped Alex. She was more like her father than he ever might have guessed. She felt comfortable in her courtroom in a way she did not feel in the confines of her own home. She knew just what to say to a defendant who'd come in with his third DUI charge, but she couldn't sustain a 5-minute conversation with her own child. 10 days after the shooting at Sterling High, Alex went into Josie's bedroom. It was mid-afternoon, and the curtains were shut tight. Josie was hidden in the cocoon she'd made of her bed covers. Although her immediate instinct was to snap open the shades and let the sunlight in, Alex lay down on the bed instead. She wrapped her arms around the bundle that was her daughter. "When you were little," Alex said, "sometimes I'd come in here and sleep with you." There was a shifting, and the sheets fell away from Josie's face. Her eyes were red-rimmed, her face swollen.
"Why?"
She shrugged.
"I was never a big fan of thunderstorms." "How come I never woke up and found you here?"
"I always went back to my own bed. I was supposed to be the tough one. I didn't want you to think I was scared of anything."
"Supermom,"
Josie whispered.
"But I'm scared of losing you," Alex said. "I'm scared it's already happened."
Josie stared at her for a moment.
"I'm scared of losing me, too."
Alex sat up and tucked Josie's hair behind her ear.
"Let's get out of here," she suggested.
Josie froze.
"I don't want to go out."
"Sweetheart, it would be good for you. It's like physical therapy, but for the brain. Go through the motions, the pattern of your everyday life, and eventually you remember how to do it naturally."
"You don't understand."
"If you don't try, Joe," she said, "then that means he wins." Josie's head snapped up. Alex didn't have to tell her who he was.
"Did you guess?"
Alex heard herself asking.
"Guess what?"
"That he might do this?"
"Mom, I don't wanna..." "I keep thinking about him as a little boy," Alex said.
Josie shook her head.
"It was a really long time ago," she murmured. "People change."
"I know. But sometimes I can still see him handing you that rifle."
"We were little,"
Josie interrupted, her eyes filling with tears.
"We were stupid."
She pushed back the covers in a sudden hurry.
"I thought you wanted to go somewhere."
Alex looked at her. A lawyer would press the point. A mother, though, might not. Minutes later, Josie was sitting in the passenger seat of the car beside Alex. She buckled the seatbelt, then unlatched it, then secured it again. Alex watched her tug on the belt to make sure it would lock up. She pointed out the obvious as they drove, that the first daffodils had pushed their brave heads through the snow on the median strip of Main Street, that the Sterling College crew team was training on the Connecticut River, the bows of their boats breaking through the residual ice, that the temperature gauge in the car said it was more than 50 degrees. Alex intentionally took the long route, the one that did not go past the school. Only once did Josie's head turn to look at the scenery, and that was when they passed the police station. Alex pulled into a parking spot in front of the diner. The street was filled with lunchtime shoppers and busy pedestrians carrying boxes to be mailed and talking on cell phones and glancing into store windows. To anyone who didn't know better, it was business as usual in Sterling.
"So,"
Alex said, turning to Josie,
"how are we doing?"
Josie looked down at her hands in her lap.
"Okay. It's not as bad as you thought, is it?"
"Not yet." My daughter the optimist. Alex smiled at her. You want to split a BLT and a salad?
You haven't even looked at a menu yet, Josie said.
And then they both got out of the car. Suddenly, a rusted Dodge Dart ran the light at the head of Main Street, backfiring.